Wat ik even goed van ik jaar niet meer zes schoenen waar ik voor jaar deze dag. So welcome again to our ongoing course on Srimad Bhagavatam. We do have some presentations scheduled for today, so I don't want to take time away from that, but I do have a few preliminaries to go through. So first thing is that there's a handout which we'd like all of you enrolled students, full-time, part-time, to take. Now, this is actually a look back. You already received the other day a list of the important verses extracted from chapters 1 through chapters 10. You all have that, yes? Very nice for your own reference. Now, this is similar, but this is an examination by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur from a work you've seen us often quote, the Bhagavad Arka Marichi Mala, of the verses of the first, not all the verses, but many of the verses, many of the same verses in the other list of Canto 1, Chapter 1 through 10. And that's dividing them over according to Sammanda, Abhidhyaya, and Prayojana. Now, when Maharaj and I first started this course together, of course, being new to this ourselves, this is a new concept, you know, that we ourselves are, as we told you, quite frankly, this is like
it's an old concept,
yeah, that we finally dug up and managed to breathe life into, and like
it was conceived in 84, and it's taken 22 years.
Been around, we want to do this so long. So, you know, and we really want to work with our students so that we're all in this together. We did notice from remarks that were spoken to me verbally and then in the essays, the feedback essays, that a good number of devotees find, you know, such a quick you know, entrance into this sort of thing, Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojana, which is actually, it's really Chaitanya Charitamrita level of philosophy, but it's Lord Chaitanya's way of explaining the whole Vedic Shastra. But in a sense, it is quite advanced. So, we're going to, for the rest of the first canto, kind of hands-off, that sort of thing. But I warn you, second canto, there's no way to avoid it, because second canto is, you know, if you thought first canto was philosophical, as I said, just wait till you get to the second canto. And that's when we're going to start to explain to you how the Srimad Bhagavatam is actually the natural commentary of Vedanta Sutra. And we have to do that in the second canto, because you may, if you're familiar with the second canto, you may remember there's a chapter called Purusha Shukta Confirmed. So Purusha Shukta is the main Vaishnava hymn, isn't it?
It's actually, Lord Chaitanya explains in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that you have the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. From that expands the Kama Gayatri. From that expands the Brahma Gayatri. Then, and that's all in the spiritual world. Then coming through the Viraja, then Omkara comes through. That expands into Burbhuvaswa, that into the Gayatri, Brahma Gayatri, that into Purusha Shukta. And the Purusha Shukta expands the Veda.
Yes. So Purusha Shukta from the Rig Veda is, in terms of the classical, what we say, the classical four Vedas, this is the greatest hymn to the Supreme Personality of God, specifically to the Supreme Lord. When you, the boys here, this is about the first Vedic mantra they learned to chant, as far as I know. And I love it, because when I'm doing my Shalagram Puja in the morning, that's at the time the boys come and chant the Purusha Shukta mantra and other Vedic mantras. So it's very, Prabhupada actually said during deity worship, the Purusha Shukta mantra should be chanted. So this is actually a direct glorification of the Supreme Lord, and the fact that this hymn is in the Rig Veda, the first of the Veda, completely annihilates right there all Mayavadi philosophy. I mean, how the Mayavadis can, you know, try to push their impersonal interpretation when right in the very first of the Vedas you have this very clear hymn glorifying Purusha, which means the personality of Godhead. Because, you know, it's, they're really doing some mental gymnastics, you know, ridiculous acrobatics with their minds. So anyway, yes, as I was saying, in second canto you have this chapter called Purusha Shukta Confirmed, which is a Bhagavatam commentary. In other words, on the Veda, because as Maharaj said, the Purusha Shukta is the essence of all the Vedas. And Vedanta is simply the Vedas, or the Upanishads. The Upanishads are the philosophical explanation of the Veda, because the Veda is ritualistic. The Purusha Shukta is chanted during yajñas. But there, in order to instruct us that the Purusha Shukta is not just some, you know, background music to a fruitive, you know, background vocalization to just fruitive activities, there's the Upanishads that help us understand the Brahman, and then mainly Brahman, mainly that's the subject matter of the Upanishads, but then there are indications of Paramatma and even Bhagavan, like in the famous well, of course, the Kali Shantarana Upanishad, which gives the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra.
Kaitreya says
the Krishna.
Raso Vaisa.
Yeah, that's in Taittiriya, but the Krishna. What's that about? The one with the Leela between Krishna, Radharani, the gopis, Agastya Muni, sage Agastya, the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. This is one of the, you know, this is actually recognized by all the Acharyas. It's one of the most well-established Upanishads. There's no doubt that, you know, some Upanishads, they raise a question whether this was written just a couple centuries ago by some Vaishnava pundit, you know, but there's no doubt about Gopal Tapani. And this goes right into Radha Krishna Leela. So anyway, this is Vedanta. Vedanta is trying to help us understand Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. But it's aimed at Brahmanas, the Brahmanas who are performing the yajñas. So it is presented in this very specialized, just like you have now, in modern Western education. I took philosophy when I was at university. And there is a language you have to learn. Otherwise, you can't discuss philosophy. There's a, you know, special jargon, special terminology. And practically every in the different divisions of Western philosophy, they will use the same terms, but then they have different permutations of meaning. And the same thing is there. Like in the six systems, you'll find the same terms. But in Nyaya, a word in Nyaya doesn't mean quite the same thing as it does in Vaisheshika or Samkhya or Yoga, or, you know, they change. So philosophy is therefore so much about language, and especially Vedic philosophy is so much about the Sanskrit language, which takes, as Prabhupada said, 12 years to learn. And most of us here, what we know about Sanskrit is what we know from Prabhupada's books. So we're unable to enter into the Vedanta Upanishads. There's the Vedanta Sutra, which is the essence of the Upanishads codified. And even that, because it's in codes, you can't understand. Some sutras are actually only one word, you know, one Sanskrit word. What does it mean?
Vakya.
Yeah, like that, Vakya. You know, what does it mean? So therefore you need the tikas of the commentaries of the different acharyas. But then you have the Advaita commentary, you have the Dvaita commentary, you have the Vishishta Dvaita commentary, you have the Dvaita Dvaita commentary. And so then these different Vaishnava and impersonalist viewpoints are there, and that's all confusing. So it is, we can't avoid to get into the subject matter in the second canto, that the Bhagavatam is Vyasadeva's own commentary on Vedanta. And this will be, you know, intellectually rather challenging, but this course that we're offering to you, it's like just now the sun is rising. So this is the concept. The sun as it's rising is spreading a gentle glow over everything. So we are trying to illuminate the subject matters of the Bhagavatam in that way, in a gentle, nice way, at your pace. So whether you're a scholarly type or, you know, more of a devoted housewife type, but who wants to know the Bhagavatam, you won't feel left out. This is our goal. I'm not saying, you know, that we've achieved that yet, but you can see we're trying. We're trying to adjust things so that everyone feels included. Nobody feels like, oh, this is just too esoteric for me. Therefore, we're putting in plays, or, you know, something for everyone just to keep your attention so we can keep going through it. You know, and those who are more intellectual will also be satisfied. And those who are less intellectual will become more interested in the deeper tattvic parts. So that's the way the course works. So for the Sambandha Abhideya Prayojan, we have this handout. This is for the verses we've already covered in the first 10 chapters. You should already be, you know, reasonably familiar, because anyway, you're not new students to the Bhagavatam. You certainly heard these verses already in classes. So now you'll have the opportunity in your own time at home to look into these categories, how Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has categorized important verses from the Bhagavatam according to Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. Actually, there's an initial categorization of Praman and Prameya, which is interesting, because that invocation of the Bhagavatam is actually Veda. It is actually Veda because it is spoken by Vyasadeva, the compiler of the Veda. So it is Veda. And then what follows that invocation is Prameya, which means it is evidence that...
What is proved?
Praman
is evidence.
Praman is evidence, and this is what is being proved.
Proved
by the evidence. In other words, it is more like the explanation of the initial evidence. So that's the initial two categories, and then we go in, then Sambandha Abhideya Prayojana. This is not going to blow any fuses in your brain, don't worry. And it's, you know, we give it to you, we're not going to pull this out in some exam in the future and make you respond, but this is just to help you, ease you into this subject, which, when we get to the second canto, we're going to have to go into deeply. You see? More deeply, more comprehensively. So this will be distributed. Another thing I want to say is, as we've already mentioned, that the day before Nityananda Trayodasi, this class will break and will not resume until March 20th. And this is because of the GBC's coming and then the... yearly festival. But to keep the fires warm, there will be a class that's going to be offered in the afternoon. Maharaj and I will discuss exactly, but it will be here. It's going to be offered during the GBC meetings, at least, which means a couple weeks. And if necessary, we'll go longer. And this is a course that I will give on, we'll say the title is Bhagavata Psychology. And I just want to briefly say what this course will be about, because it is for those who are interested in tattva. You see, like I said, this class is like the rising sun, but this Bhagavata psychology class will be like a laser beam that is going to penetrate through walls and walls and walls of ignorance about the most difficult parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Second canto, third canto, seventh canto, 11th canto. And it's all from the angle of vision of psychology. Because in Vedic, Vedic philosophy in toto, there's a principle of macrocosm, microcosm, which also comes up in Western philosophy. The human being is, because we have this project out here. Sometimes devotees come to me and ask me, what my opinion is of how the temple of understanding should look like. And I say, why are you asking me about what it should look like when if it's going to be a Vedic planetarium, it should start with Shabda, sound. And that should be the leading sense. I mean, this is what I say. I don't know what Maharaj says, but this is my reply. So anyway, this course is going to be taking you along that avenue, it's about psychology, the workings of the mind, but it's going to remove us completely from our Western orientation of everything we understand, because we understand everything through the mind, you see. So this is going to take our minds out of the whole Western context and place it into the Bhagavata context. And we are going to be examining the most difficult, or some of the most difficult, challenging verses and purports, so that we can learn two things simultaneously. How our own minds work, you see. What is the subconscious? Where our desires come from. How the mind is supposed to work in bhakti yoga. What are the secrets the acharyas have given for controlling the mind in bhakti yoga, particularly Ramanujacharya. Why Ramanujacharya? Because in the purport, Srila Prabhupada specifically praises Ramanujacharya for his work in this area, because his philosophy is Vishishta Dvaita, which is specifically this microcosm, macrocosm. In other words, the human body is simply a replica of the entire universe. So whatever is happening within us is based upon the Hiranyagarbha form of the Lord. So his mind is the original mind. So all the breakdown you read in the third canto of the Shaktis evolving into gunas, the gunas evolving into mind, intelligence, false ego, and then from there the senses coming. Out of the mode of goodness come the jnana indriyas, out of the mode of passion come the karma indriyas. And all of that constitutes a subtle body. And then you have the gross body, which is hardly even discussed because it's just the glove fitting the hand. The real body is the subtle body. So this course, which will be offered during the GBC meetings, is really, see, on the one side, it's attractive to everyone, because I know, even the Matajis especially, I know from their questions that they ask, they're very interested in the mind. The mind actually symbolizes the feminine nature, because the mind is associated with the moon, which is considered feminine, and the sun is masculine. The sun represents the intelligence. So the mind reflects the intelligence and reflects that intelligence into the senses, and this is how everything works inside of us. And the intelligence is, of course, the Prabhupada said, like that with the Paramatma. And then the whole thing that makes psychology difficult is desires, because desires are more subtle than the mind. So, all of this and much more, including we're going to go from that into typology. The typology of course, Varnashram Dharma. That means different types of personalities. So there's Varnashram Dharma, but there's Jyotish. This is elemental. The elemental principles of the typology of personality according to Jyotish and Ayurveda, and I believe also Natya Shastra has a lot to say about that. This, that'll be overview at the end. And also, interestingly enough, we'll be getting into psychological diseases too. The Vedic explanation of psychological disease. So I'm sure you're all interested in that. But at the same time, I want to warn you that unlike this class, that class will be pulling no philosophical punches. So if you're interested in philosophy, come. If you're scared of philosophy and interested in the mind, come anyway, but you may find yourself being left behind because this is like an express train. You know, this is the express train where, but it's good because if you can sit through this class, then you'll be very well prepared. You'll have an extra edge when we come back with the regular Bhagavatam course. You'll have really gained some very deep insights into Bhagavata philosophy. I guarantee on this, you this, because, and hopefully, oh, Nitai Goranga hasn't come yet. He said he would come. Oh, you're there! Sitting in the, yeah, you told me you're shy. Last night I was talking, he has a BA in psychology. So we are trying by gentle means to get him involved in this class. So that we'll teach it. I mean, I'm going to be the main speaker because the main viewpoint is Vedic, but we want him to be there to give the Western, in other words, basically what we want you to see is how deficient Western psychology is. And he'll be able, with his education, to help you understand how Western psychology is a very inept science, and therefore the role it plays in today's ISKCON is, you know, just makes me scratch my head. So this is the real purpose of our course. One of the real purposes is we want to establish that if you want to know psychology, it's all there in the Srimad Bhagavatam to a degree that that very few devotees have been able to appreciate. There's more information about psychology. Just like a very good Ayurvedic Vaishnava member, Ayurvedic doctor who is trained as a PhD in Ayurveda and works at the Bhaktivedanta Hospital in Mumbai, disciple of Radhanath Maharaj. He also told me, he said Ayurveda is actually mainly about psychology, but the devotees don't know that. They think it's just about the body and the doshas, but it's mainly also a science of psychology. So there's no need to read books on Freud and Jung and Adler and all those guys when you've got such, you know, we've got the real tattva of what the mind is, how it works. And so that's what this course will be about. So we'll tell you more as we're able to actually schedule it. And I've already talked quite enough. We should now go into the presentations. And we have three for today. The first one will be on Maharaj. Yes. Only two? There's three. So I think we have time enough for three. One last thing is that today I'll be writing the weekend essay question. So tomorrow, by the end of the class, if you intend to make a presentation, you have to submit your proposal to us by then. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck with writing the essay. Because, you know, there has to be a cutoff point. So we heartily invite you to kindly volunteer to participate, but we have to give, you know, a cutoff time. And that will be at the end of tomorrow's class. So you think about it. Go, you know, listen carefully to the presentations today, again this evening. Look at our chapter summary. Look at Prabhupada's purports. Think. And then we can schedule you in for next week, what you submit tomorrow. But if you don't submit anything by the end of tomorrow's class, you'll be stuck with writing the essay. Business finished. And maybe next chapter, you know, you can make a presentation. So is that clear? Has everyone understood that? It's a very important point. Okay, then we will now turn the class over to our Bhakta David, who is going to be speaking on, particularly on verse 9 of this chapter. Oh, and yes, since the attendees, the auditors are always changing, you know, I always see new faces. So I would like to request everyone to introduce themselves. I've already introduced you, but you can just repeat the introduction yourself just to get... We want everyone coming forward just to say who you are. You know, you don't have to give us your biography. Just introduce yourself by name.
You don't need to know the brand of pretzels
Yes. Your
mother was eating.
Right. Just giving us your name is enough. And that's even though, you know, the regular students hopefully by now pretty much know each other, but they're always new persons, so we'd like the new persons to know who's speaking. That's why we ask you every time to make an introduction of yourself. Okay?
Okay. So, in case you missed it, my name is David. I'm not too happy about that, but...
But he is a teacher here in our institution.
Either was Goliath.
Although his name is David, he's very highly qualified.
Yeah. No. I guess, you know, names are associated with, if you have, you know, self-hatred issues, then you're not going to like your name much either. So.
I'm not good with the slink.
Pardon?
I'm not good with the slink.
Well, the Old Testament is a great soul. Bletcher Shoshua.
Okay. I really wanted to say something about text 9, but briefly I just want to mention something about text 34, which, you know, describes, this is coming at the end of the 11th chapter, and just kind of giving a final concluding glorification of the Lord, and, you know, describing or summarizing his activities at Kurukshetra. And in the last part of the shloka, it says that the Lord was not party in the fight. He simply created hostility between the powerful administrators. And they fought amongst themselves. He was like the wind which causes friction between bamboos and so sparks of fire. So the first time I read this, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Krishna just kind of gets all the demons to kill themselves. He doesn't, you know, have to get involved himself. He, you know, stirs things up a little bit, but he just lets them, you know, shoot each other, really. So I was kind of thinking about how, you know, that would apply to our world today. You know, there's different theories. People have written many books. I think there was one book written by a guy. He was an ex-American military personnel. He wrote a book called The Clash of Civilizations. And he predicted, you know, great upheavals and, you know, conflicts between the Orient and the West. Anyway, so kind of one of my, you know, speculations is that you'll have the capitalists, the communists, the fascists, and fundamental, you know, Islamic fundamentalists, and, you know, they'll eventually just get together and kill each other, and the devotees will be left to pick up the pieces and, you know, start a new world order.
Watch out for that new world order, please.
I don't know if that'll happen, but it'll be interesting to see. Anyway.
I always get nervous when everyone starts to talk about that. Oh, please continue.
That's okay. So yeah, that's just you know, kind of point that I felt about that might happen.
Because it's only devotees who are part of this.
But okay. So text 9. When the Lord comes into Dwarka, then the citizens start offering prayers and glorification. And the shloka is translated as, O Lotus Eye Lord, whenever you go away to Mathura, Vrindavan or Hastinapur to meet your friends and relatives, every moment of your absence seems like a million years. O infallible one, at that time our eyes become useless, as if bereft of sun. So I picked this verse not because I have ever experienced feelings of separation like this, but what struck me was the statement that Srila Prabhupada makes, at that time our eyes become useless, as if bereft of sun. So this is very kind of, it just struck me. It's like if Krishna is there, then something's worthwhile, something's interesting. And if Krishna is not there, then what's the point? I didn't really want to, you know, speak and read out a whole, you know, set of points or prose that I've written. I wanted to have, you know, cues or points that I could refer to and then talk about. But last night when I was looking at this, I kind of found myself writing down, you know, what my, you know, my thought process was producing. So I will, you know, read some of the things that I wrote down. So please bear with me. The first thing I kind of thought was that, well, Krishna invests value in things. Meaning, when our senses are invested in the other, they have value. I can say there's two things. There's the same, or the self, and then there's the other. There's a separation, there's a difference, there's a duality. There's me here, localized in this particular place, and then there's all of you there. And ultimately, there's God. And, you know, for me, all of you are representing, all of you are representing God to me, because you're part of Him. So, when our senses are invested in the other, then they have value. It's like life stops if there's no Krishna. What's the point? I don't know, did you ever think that maybe everyone was a player in your own little world? Or that you were being observed? Maybe someone's kind of, you know, having some fun with you and seeing how you, you know, react to different situations and, you know, to different people. And everything's just set up just for you, right? Well, there was a film made a few years ago. It was called The Truman Show, about this guy, Truman. And his whole life was a TV show, but he knew nothing about it. Everything that was set up, everything that was created in his little village, in his little world, was just so that, you know, they could have cameras on him 24/7, and everybody could see what he was doing. And he had no idea what was going on. He thought everybody was having their own little life and this and that. But actually, everyone in his world was just an actor, and they all had different parts to play in his life story. And everybody in the outside world was watching it on TV. You know, and they were plugged in. And so life revolved around Truman. And I guess in the material world, we would like life to revolve around us. And, you know, we probably think it does. And everyone also imagines the same. You know, because we're pretending to be in the center. Because we are in the center. I can only experience what, you know, I'm feeling and I'm doing in my body. You all have different experiences of what's going on in your lives. So we're in the center of our, you know, perspective. But we're not the center for anybody except ourselves. But Krishna really is the hub of life. If he's not in the picture, then the show is empty. It's like everyone that isn't involved in the immediate action freezes till they're needed. This is what struck me about the verse, is that if Krishna's not there, our eyes are useless. They don't work. They don't have any engagement. They don't have any activity. So if Krishna's not in the frame, if he's not in the show, then practically whatever else is going on, you could just freeze, you know, and just wait for Krishna to come back in. So either you're freezing or you're getting into your position and learning your lines. So that's what I guess I imagined the situation in Dwarka to be like. Everybody's just, you know, freezing, waiting for Krishna. Or when he left Vrindavan, everybody was just stunned and just lifeless. It's just like, what are we going to do? You know, there's no Krishna. So So then I was thinking, trying to compare when Krishna is here and then what life is like without Krishna, or what activity is like without Krishna. So I was thinking that there's so many things that we could be or do. Everybody's interested in doing something in this world. We have a vision, we have a desire, and then the super soul reciprocates with that desire. We have an idea of ourselves, what we want to be, and you know the super soul is giving us direction. So I could be a professor, I could be a protest singer, I could be a recording artist, I could be a film actor, I could be an Olympic legend, I could be the toast of my nation on a rugby field. Or I could be scared to fail. I could be scared to discover that I'm none of those things and then get a job as a postman and not have to think, not have to face myself. Or I could be scared to discover that I can be all those things, but realize when I get there that I'm an imposter, that I'm independent. Sorry, that I'm dependent. That no matter how much people tell me I'm wonderful and I've made it, I know I'm not myself. I've stolen someone else's part because it's not my part to play God. So the point is that there are so many things we could do or be, but if Krishna is not involved, if Krishna is not at the center, then all of it's a waste of time. Because even, you know, you get to be king of the castle, you know, it's like, okay, great, I'm king of the castle, what next? You know, it's not really satisfying. So that's the kind of proof of the pudding, that we're not designed for that position. So it's a waste of time because nothing in this material world, nothing stays, nothing's reliable. And worldly people don't really love us. Nobody exists exclusively for us. Everybody is needy. Everybody wants a piece of the attention, the glory, the beauty, the fashion, the credibility, the status, right? Nobody really cares if you have it or someone else has it. They just want it for themselves, and they'll use you to get it if you happen to have it, right? So everyone's competing. Therefore, people are attracted to wherever opulence is. But it doesn't matter if you have it or someone else has it. As individuals, we're expendable. People aren't interested in your soul. They're interested in your externals, generally. I'm talking, you know, in a very materialistic society. But then, who really has all those things? Who really has all the opulences that we're interested in? It's Krishna. And why are we interested in them? Because we think that if we get them, we'll be lovable. We really just want to be loved like Krishna. We're actually looking for love, but we don't know that, so we accept its, you know, poor substitutes: fame, position, respect, glory, worship. But we just want to be loved like Krishna. But we don't understand that Krishna has those opulences because he is lovable. Why is he lovable? And then if you break this word lovable, it means, you know, love able. So that can be looked at from two angles. He's able to give love and he's able to accept love. Right? He's capable of love and he's also he's able to be loved. Right? So he's lovable because he's lovable because he's lovable because he himself loves by the very act of expanding others who will love him. Okay? He's lovable because he himself loves by the very act of expanding others who will love him. So by his expansions, he is an act of love. He gives us life. And then his expansions are loving him. So this relationship that's created is a relationship of love. He creates that. He is the source of that. Krishna gives us life, therefore we will find life in him. Everybody's looking for love, but why don't we relate to the very person who has love for us? So I'll just conclude. I don't know about you, but I guess I've experienced this practically. Although, you know, you can say I've realized something, I've experienced something, but still, you know, you keep, you know, doing the opposite thing. It's like a constant, it's a constant uphill fight to, you know, to change, to adjust your mentality, to accept something. You know it's true, but, you know, to accept it is another thing. So it's especially noticeable in anything that naturally brings recognition. You know, this comparative mentality. Anything that you do that will bring recognition, like giving a presentation, like singing, okay? If I try to flaunt my stuff, you know, thinking that, yeah, I can do this, I'm really good at this. If I try to flaunt my stuff just so everyone will notice me, I never feel satisfied. And everyone else will hate me or just think, man, you suck. And it's true. You get, you know, you feel that. But if I try to get over myself and remember who gives the ability and make it nice for Krishna and the devotees, then the result is very different. And I actually get, you know, what I'm looking for. I actually get the fruits that I want. You know, everything will come. I get the satisfaction of experiencing that I am Krishna's servant. And I will also get the attention and the love that I'm looking for. But at that point, you know, I don't care if you think I'm great. I don't care. But I'll be happy to receive it. But because I'll be satisfied that, you know, this is my relationship with the Lord, and He's pleased if I do this, and I will feel His reciprocation. So that's what came out of text 9. And yeah, I won't say anymore.
I want to make two quick comments. In the United States, particularly in the black community, you know, African American section of society, there's an expression of approval when someone says something that meets great approval. Then someone else will say, "Now that's what I'm talking about." That immediately came to my mind when I was listening, because what you have presented is really so wonderful. It so wonderfully essentializes the whole point of this course. What, at least from my perspective, what I want to bring out. So I was really happy to hear this. It was very moving, because it was your own personal realization. And yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And the second thing is when you were talking about, you know, you're good at something by the grace of the modes of nature, and then this becomes your, in ISKCON, I don't think we still use this in ISKCON, but Maharaj definitely remembers this word profile used to have a special meaning in ISKCON at one time. You know, there was this term, the Swami profile. So if you're going to take sannyas, there was a certain way you were expected to act. And the older Swamis, they would say, "Hey, that's not the profile. You know, you got to walk like this, and talk like this." You know, they expect all the sannyasis to behave in a certain way. Right? You know, Maharaj knows very well what I'm saying. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, in his introduction to the Sri Brahma Samhita, he writes at one point about mundane scholars who attempt to explain the absolute truth by their, they're gifted by material nature with a great intellect and mastery of knowledge, and they're able to assemble different ideas and points of view in a very interesting way. But he sums it all up with this very, I'm just so taken by this expression, it's just a two-word phrase, but it says so much. He sums that all that up with the phrase, savage demonstration. Meaning, you know, it's just savagery. It's just, you know, like the primitives of the Amazon of South America, when they paint themselves up with, you know, red and blue and They tie their hair up in all kinds of weird, exotic ways with feathers. And you know, it's a demonstration of something very remarkable, but it is savage. It's not doing anything else than just asserting one's own false ego in a very interesting way. So, you know, yeah, you find it. Yeah, everyone's looking like, wow. And in modern Western society, we see, especially among young people, that sort of caught on, that sort of, you know, tribal culture of pink and blue hair coming out in like coils of snakes and, you know, in different weird clothing and strange music. And everyone's just trying to savagely demonstrate their identity. But that's all it is. It's just, it's not cultured at all. It's just savagery. It's just a form of, you know, most primitive level of consciousness. So I just want to make those two quick remarks. Maybe Maharaj has something to say, or anyone have anything they'd like to? Okay. So then we have still 12 minutes left, and I think our next presentation, oh, Shanti Parayan Prabhu is actually the next one. He wants to speak on this first chapter of the second page of the Shloka Anusana. So, you think you can do it in 12 minutes? We can give you part one, part two, if you want. Okay, don't worry about that, okay? You don't have to. We want you to feel that they have to squeeze their presentation. You know, we're very happy to, we have to stop at 9, and if you haven't finished, we're very happy to give you, you know, first slot the next day, so you can finish up what you started. Remember, you should introduce yourself.
My name is Shanti Parayan Das.
Hey, well,
how are you?
Nice to meet you.
So the verse that has inspired me to investigate more of the Bhagavatam is this verse in the 11th chapter, text number 12. It describes the perfection of human civilization, Dwarka. These points have been, well, these verses, similar verses have been spoken by Queen Kunti. Krishna, you are here, so the earth is providing everything in abundance. There's plenty to eat, the cows are providing plenty of milk. And then, in the previous chapter, in response to the question of the sages, what is Maharaj Yudhisthira doing now that there's no obstacles to his ruling? How is he enjoying the kingdom? So there's another series of verses that describes how the kingdom is flourishing. Year-round, Dwarka City was blessed by the opulences of all seasons simultaneously. It was the site of countless hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and ponds from which lovely lotuses bloomed. Beautiful descriptions. It's what we could imagine, everything working nicely, everything there in full abundance, what we could imagine heaven would be like. And the spiritual world's another dimension when there's nice interactions and we don't grow old. We exist eternally. So here, these descriptions give a nice picture. And I've understood that at different times in the Bhagavatam you get a full vision. You get a description of Krishna in all of his opulences with his peacock. You see Krishna's smiling face. Every now and then it just gets dropped in. So here's a vision of perfection of human civilization. But then you go into the purports and you understand how these things are going to be achieved. Prabhupada, he used to talk about the ideal civilization. He would say that people are always looking for Ram Raja. He even said if we had Ravan Raja, we would be happy. Yeah. Because the proper organization by a person who understands the Vedas, this would be satisfying for us. So, Ravana was a great Brahmana. Now we've got what Prabhupada calls humbug civilization. Or at the end of this purport, it's described a dungeon of demons. That's the civilization we're living in. That's because we don't have a bona fide devotee, kshatriya, ruler. Maharaj Yudhisthira, he was put into position by Lord Krishna because he was having no other separate ideology. He wanted to present his service to maintain the citizens for Krishna's pleasure, so that all of these citizens would be satisfied. And he was the autocrat. He had the power to do that, to control the whole world, vested in him by Krishna. And Prabhupada says that he was representing Krishna, Naradev. The king is the representative of all the demigods. He's the representative of Krishna. So Krishna was protecting everybody through Maharaj Yudhisthira. He felt protected. Everybody was free from anxiety, free from disease, free from shortage. Everything was there. So we've experienced some practical demonstrations of this. We were traveling to a place in Indonesia, central Sulawesi. We arrived there, got out of the plane, and there was this dust bowl, windswept, dry, harsh environment with goats running around. And we asked, what's going on here? They said, this is the Muslim village. They drove us up over a hill. The roads were terrible, so it took them about 4 hours to get over the hill. The other side, just the other side of this peninsula, was heaven. And what was the difference? On this side was the Hindu community. What's the difference? The ideology. There was rice paddies. There were banana plantations. There was a beautiful bay. There was everything. And devotees having big festivals there. Complete difference in contrast with the attitude of the people directing. And there was also, they depicted it in a movie, Arthur, the Round Table. When the king was on top of things, then everybody was happy. He fell from grace, so everything became black and white. Everything was dilapidated. There was nothing growing. When he came back into grace, they just switched on the colour. Everything just became alive again. So this is the potency or the influence of an authorised representative of Krishna. So these natural gifts of civilization, they help to nourish the finer sentiments of the individual. The finer sentiments such as justice, compassion for life, friendliness towards other living beings, and loving kindness. Brahminical qualities. The modern civilization says these are like feminine, weak, indicative of not being able to master your environment. And they're cultivating the other qualities of lewdness, destruction of nature and the environment, cruelty to animals. Prabhupada in these three sections, he goes back again and again. Slaughtering of animals? Is this civilization? Is this civilized? When you've got all these natural gifts, you should be satisfied not to kill the animals. But this is one of the major platforms of modern society. Killing animals, torturing the other creatures. So the devotees, with access to this information, description, they cultivate these finer sentiments. And by kindness, showing loving kindness, friendliness towards other living beings, compassion for life and a sense of justice, they overcome the influence of the horrible age which we're living in. So it's a practical process for changing the dungeon of demons into the spiritual world. Start to understand our relationship with Krishna. Start to understand our nature, our essential nature. Start to dwell within these finer sentiments. And we'll notice a transformation. Another graphic example of how degraded the world became was in the time of Maharaj Prithu, that the earth was withholding all of the natural opulences. So he had to milk, he had to extract those seeds and grains back again from the earth. So the same thing now. We've got restriction, we've got suffering, that nobody's got enough to eat. The people here, the villagers, are sweeping the forest to get a few leaves so they can cook some sabji. And they work all day just to get enough fuel to be able to cook. Then they can only cook once a day. They don't have the opportunity for two or even three meals a day. There's a shortage. So if the if Krishna is pleased because the devotees are understanding his direction, are applying Krishna consciousness rather than Western values, and Bhavananda was telling us, you guys, your problem is you're still convinced that the Western civilization has got something to offer. There's nothing there, nothing of value in the Western civilization.
I like the Rivas.
And Prabhupada, he demonstrated how practical this spiritual culture is. He would often defeat the scientists, not by taking part their argument and giving them a scientifically logical answer, but just by being stuck on the Vedic paradigm. You say you went to the moon. Did you see the kusha grass, which was effulgent? Did you see the rivers of nectar? Did you see? You didn't go to the moon. It's not describing the Vedic. You went to a dust bowl. So he just stuck to what he understood was the description of the Vedas, and that defeated him by his conviction. So we also have to give up our attachment for our conditioning and embrace the reality of the Bhagavatam. And then the transformation of ourselves, our own consciousness, and the transformation of the planet will be witnessed as an actual fact. What is this?
It was wonderful because when David Prabhu was speaking, remember I interrupted and I said, you know, just made this, it was joking, but watch out about this New World Order talk. And your presentation actually brought out why I'm always cautious. Because we find in a purport, you know, when I hear devotees talking about when we take over, then, you know, this or that. Because what we find in Prabhupada's books is that the Varnashram Dharma, there are two essential components, the Brahmana and the Kshatriya. Now, we have in the world today, in ISKCON, and even outside of ISKCON, there are Brahmanas. Right? Maharaj will agree with me. There are many Brahmanas. But harder to find in this world, much, 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 much harder to find in this world is a real Kshatriya. And therefore, whenever I hear devotees talking loosely about, you know, what will happen when we take over, my God. Prabhupada said, Krishna could, it was a famous quote, Krishna can give you the world in 18 days, just as he gave it in 18 days to the Pandavas, but what would you do with it? You know, and that's when at our highest managerial levels, we are still trying to figure out, you know, discussing how do we define renunciation in ISKCON, or what is a sannyasi in ISKCON, or, you know, these basic things, this is what we talk about, you know, basic definitions, we're in trouble. That's what brahmanas do. Brahmanas can go on endlessly, you know, it's called parsing words, you know, it's just endlessly parsing words, you know, down to their roots and building them back up, and they can, you know, go on months and months, and meanwhile, you know, outside, everything's going to hell. That's why you have to have a kshatriya who says to the brahmanas, I want an answer tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And if I don't get one, there's going to be some trouble around here. And the brahmanas say, yes, sir. Not because he's their superior, but the brahmanas have to be motivated in that way. They're as much as the king respects and serves the brahmanas also respect. I remember Maharaj once telling me that many, many years ago. It was a very nice point. He said, the brahmanas, the quality of brahmanas, that they always appreciate the qualities of the kshatriyas. They admire the kshatriyas because they see the difference between a brahmana and a kshatriya. You know, you have I think I mentioned that here, didn't I? That Karna refused to kill Maharaj Yudhisthira because they said, you're really a brahmana. They're practically, I mean, a real kshatriya who's really been educated is practically a brahmana. But the thing is, he doesn't teach. He puts into practice the teachings. He makes sure that what the Vedas say gets done. And he has the power to do that. Whereas the brahmanas are teaching, which is equally important. So the brahmanas, a real brahmana appreciates a real kshatriya. A real brahmana loves to see that all this that I'm, you know, this vibration that I'm letting out into the air is actually manifesting in reality because of the strong arms of this kshatriya who knows exactly what I'm saying because his intelligence is practically equal to mine. Even though the brahmanas, as we see, great brahmanas, will submissively be submissive before real kshatriyas will take the submissive role before brahmanas because they love to hear. They have a taste for hearing, so they want the brahmanas to speak. But they grasp it like Parikshit Maharaj grasps. He has like a mind like a bear trap, just grasps what Sukadeva Goswami is saying. So that means he's equally as intelligent. But someone has to be the teacher and someone has to be the executor. So that's really, in real Vedic society, you know, that's the difference, the essential difference between brahmanas and kshatriyas. Of course, kshatriyas know how to fight and they, you know, but a kshatriya is not a jumped-up martial artist. That's a big mistake. There's some devotees who think that's what it means. I remember hearing once about a devotee who saw some ugly kind of bug crawling on the ground, a praying mantis or something, and he said, that's a kshatriya bug. No, sorry. Just because some living entity has a bodily form that's able to inflict, you know, great pain upon another living entity does not qualify him to be called a kshatriya. That's like Shudras are very expert in hurting one another. The word Shudra indicates someone who's suffering. And suffering means also to give suffering to others. So anyway, I very much appreciated your presentation. And well, we have to stop now, unfortunately. So we have Prahlad Nisringa Prabhu online for tomorrow. And today, before you leave, anyone who has selected a topic should please come forward and give it to us today so we can schedule you in. And tomorrow will be your last opportunity to do that. So if you have a topic, please come forward. And remember, we have this handout for you on the Bhagavad Arka Marichimala. We want everyone who's an enrolled student to have this and take it home and just read it. You're not going to be tested on it, but just to help you to get into Sambandha Abhideya Prayojan. All right then. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jai.